Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. We have a very interesting and informative show for you today. Many people lately have been asking me to have Professor Francis Boyle on the show on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. So we caught up with him today. Francis Boyle is a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law. He received a JD degree magna cum laude and AM and PhD degrees in political science from Harvard University. He also practiced tax and international tax law with Bingham, Dana, and Gould. Professor Boyle, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Well, Cindy, thank you very much for having me on, the best to your listening audience. And, of course, congratulations to you for all the fine work you've done for the peace movement ever since the tragic death of your son.
Oh, thank you so much. I was telling you before we started the interview that many, many, many of my listeners always request that I interview you, so I'm really happy that we made it work this week and that you're able to be on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Well, you have a very extensive resume, and I think we could do a whole show on every piece of your resume.
I think we dispense with the resume.
You just have been very dedicated to social justice and international peace and justice for your whole career. And, of course, you have to be congratulated and thanked for that also. But I'm going to give my listeners an opportunity to ask you some questions via email that they've already written to me. But the first thing I want to talk about is your experience with Amnesty International, because I'm writing a book about Venezuela, and I am often confused about Amnesty International's reports on Venezuela, because they seem just to go hand in hand with what the U.S. empire says about Venezuela, or now even Libya. And I don't want to talk about Amnesty International's criticisms of Venezuela or Libya right now. I just want your experience. I want you to tell my listeners about your experience with Amnesty International, because you were on the board of directors.
I was elected to two terms on the board of directors, and I was nominated by the membership, not through this cozy little self-selection process they have. Well, what can I say? Amnesty is such an enormous organization. I haven't really followed what they've said about Venezuela, but what you said is correct. Basically, Amnesty operates as an ideological tool of the U.S. Empire, the British Empire, and the Israeli Empire. Just to give you two examples, most telling of why you can't believe anything Amnesty says about the Middle East. And if you do a Google under my name and Dennis Bernstein, you'll come up with a very extensive interview I gave him on Amnesty, specifically with respect to the Middle East. I was one of the co-founders of the Amnesty International coordination group on the Middle East. And at our first meeting, I said, you know, if we don't do something to criticize what Israel is doing to the Palestinians and the Lebanese, that time they'd invaded Lebanon, we'll have no credibility at all. I was immediately blackballed off the Middle East co-group by instructions from their board of directors. I got on the board when they blackballed off a group of us from the ballot because we were there to get them to do more on behalf of the Palestinians and the Lebanese.
Right.
And my colleagues asked me to represent them. I threatened a lawsuit. Not only did I threaten it, I had to go out to New York to file it. There were no reasonable good faith negotiations at all. And they literally settled the day before I was to file the lawsuit in New York, which is how I got on their board.
Mm-hmm.
I won't go through the long history here of how biased Amnesty is on the Middle East against Arabs and Muslims and in favor of the United States, Britain, and Israel. But just to give you an example, the worst example of all, of course, was the Kuwaiti Dead Babies Report. I was on the Amnesty Board at the time. I got an advance copy. I was actively involved in trying to prevent the U.S. war against Iraq. This was late December or so, 1990. I immediately read the report. It was a slipshod, shoddy piece of work, obviously whipped together, very short notice, did not pass normal Amnesty International quality control standards. And as for the point about the dead babies being put on the, taken out of incubators and put on floors by Iraqi soldiers, I didn't know if that was true or not, but it sounded highly suspicious and in any event would be used clearly to provoke warfare. So I did everything humanly possible to prevent the publication of that report, as did another board member who I alerted to the problem. It was reported, it was published anyway, no corrections, no nothing, no errata, and both myself and my fellow board member inquired into this matter separately, and we concluded that the person on the Amnesty staff who put this report together worked for British intelligence.
Wow.
Amnesty headquarters in London is penetrated all up and down by British intelligence, and indeed, just recently, they're quoted in the New York Times, their expert on counterterrorism and terrorism at Amnesty headquarters in London is a former British intelligence agent. It was right there. I just cited this to my students. As for Amnesty International USA, it's basically an arm of the Likud party. And that, you know, so on the Middle East, certainly that's true. But again, I really haven't followed anything related to Arabs and Muslims, the Middle East. Whatever they have to say is completely worthless, and it's pretty much propaganda. But I refer you to my interview with Dennis Bernstein that goes through this in more detail. As for Chavez, I'm sorry, I just haven't followed their coverage in that area.
Well, I have, and I get the same sense that it's exactly what you're talking about with the coverage of the Middle East. It's just, I think they're just there to reinforce U.S. propaganda against anybody. It appears to be against anybody that the U.S. happens to be demonizing at the time. But before I get into the questioners from the listeners, you said something about the U.S. Empire, the British Empire, and the Israeli Empire. My question is there a difference could we say the Israel-U.S.-British Empire without separating them?
Well, I think, you know, each government empire has its own imperial interests, and I think that any analysis, at least that I do try to break them down a bit. I do agree with Noam Chomsky that after World War II, Britain became the United States' loyal lieutenant, and pretty much do what we tell them to do, although not completely, the Suez Crisis in the Middle East. And Israel will pretty much do what we tell them to do, but not completely. So I think, for my purposes, my analytical purposes, I do single them out. For example, even on Amnesty International, their headquarters in London is just bigoted and racist against Irish. I can just tell you that, having been very actively involved and on the board for 4 years. That is not the case about Amnesty International USA, and I did get use Amnesty International USA against Amnesty headquarters in London on a variety of issues. So, you know, there are imperial differences. It's not necessarily the case that the interests are completely the same.
Okay, thank you. Now we'll get into my listeners' questions, and we'll do as many of them as we can in the time we have left. I have a question from a listener, Kathy Garger, and she says, in your opinion, that means you, Professor Boyle. Why has the UN not investigated the NATO allies for genocide of radioactive munitions in Iraq and Afghanistan?
As we're seeing today in Libya, the United Nations has simply become a handmaiden of the United States. And I regret to say that I used to be a big UN supporter, but no more. The UN just does, it's bought and paid for. Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General, is just a flunky for the Americans. And the whole Secretariat does whatever they're told to do in the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iraq, whatever. So the UN isn't really going to help us here. It's up to us, the American people, to try to bring under control our own lawless criminal government, whether it's being run by Democrats or Republicans. Obama has made, you know, no difference at all. He's just started another war. So,
well, absolutely. And it sounds like the UN has about the same kind of mission that Amnesty International does. Do you think there are any international movements or institutions that we could trust to be in opposition to U.S. imperial designs?
Not really, no. Either they're bought off or corrupted long ago by the United States government. And again, I really think it's up to us, the American people. I filed a complaint against Bush and the rest of them with the International Criminal Court for extraordinary rendition,
right,
which is enforced disappearances of human beings and their torture. And the complaint was Bush, Cheney, Rice, Rumsfeld, Gonzalez, and Tenet. And I had a slam dunk case to be filed with the International Criminal Court. That was a year ago, and they haven't done anything. The International Criminal Court, despite expectations I had for it, has itself become nothing more than a tool of Western imperialism, as
mm-hmm.
you see in Libya and Africa today. So it's very unfortunate what happened. But look, most of the bills for the ICC get paid for by Germany and Japan anyway. You know,
right,
all these NGOs, they operate on the principle, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And the United States still pays about 25% of the UN budget. I haven't seen the exact figures in a while.
Right.
The ICC, most of it is paid for by Germany, Japan, and the European states. So it's just been transmogrified into a tool, another tool of Western imperialism to be used against Africa, the Middle East, and whatever. So I'm sorry to say that. I've given it more than enough time to look into these issues.
Uh-huh.
The ICC also refused to do anything about Tony Blair's war crimes in Iraq, even though Tony Blair, Britain was a party to the ICC statute. The ICC has refused to do anything about the U.S. NATO war crimes in Afghanistan, even though Afghanistan is a party to the ICC statute. They've refused to do anything about Israel, even though the Palestinian state accepted the jurisdiction of the ICC.
Mm-hmm.
So I could continue, you know, with the long list here of things they've refused to act on and things that they are acting on. And the common denominator is the ICC does whatever their paymasters tell them to do. So it's a very sad, sad situation, Cindy. But again, the bottom line is we're not going to be able to rely on any of these outside international institutions to help save our democracy, our republic here in America. You had the right idea in the first time, which was civil resistance. That, you know, we have First Amendment rights, and
mm-hmm.
people are going to have to go out in the streets in a peaceful, nonviolent way and protest and demonstrate just like we did to end the Vietnam War. So, you know, you were right the first time when you set up shop there in Crawford, Texas.
Well, and unfortunately, it didn't. My goals still haven't been met, and I think that's partially because the Democratic Party really knows how to co-opt social movements that might be affected. But I want to go
that's
on
correct,
to...
That's correct, Cindy. Most of the peace movements,
yep.
which I've tried to work with, are pretty much front organizations for the Democratic Party. 2 weeks ago, for example, I was on this Uniting for Peace and Justice website, their email list, and I called for Obama to be impeached because of the bombing of Libya, and they immediately knocked me off the list.
Right.
And the same is true for Move On and many of these other organizations. I don't mean to call into question the good faith and integrity of people at the grassroots level.
Right.
But I think they have to realize that those at the top who control and dominate these organizations are working hand in glove with the Democratic Party to keep the peace movement inactive and ineffective.
When you name two of the top offenders, UFPJ and MoveOn.org, certainly they're there. They have the biggest list. They have the most money. They have the biggest opportunity to influence people away from true change. But let's go on to my next question for you from Lee Burkett. And I think you answered it just a little bit in your last answer, but he wants to know, how can the American people hope to see justice from our judicial system when it's abundantly clear that there is a two-tiered system of justice in place? And Wall Street's not only too big to fail, but it's also apparently too big to face criminal charges.
Well, of course, that is correct. Certainly the federal judicial system today is hostile to a rule of law, civil rights, civil liberties, human rights, international law. We have to understand that about 60% of all federal judges today at all levels, from the district court up to the Supreme Court, have been appointed by Reagan, Bush Sr., Bush Jr., and they were either members of this right-wing, racist, bigoted, reactionary, warmongering, totalitarian Federalist Society, or had been vetted by Federalist Society members in these three administrations to have viewpoints compatible.
Mm-hmm.
So the federal courts are not going to save us. That's correct. It's extremely hostile environment for any progressive in federal courts today because of the takeover of the U.S. federal judicial system at all levels up to the Supreme Court where you have five members of the Federalist Society, and even Kagan says, quote, I love the Federalist Society up there.
Mm-hmm.
The state courts are a little better because for the most part they're elected by the people of their community. So you do have a better shot in a state court than federal courts. But again, under these circumstances, the only real alternative we have is our First Amendment rights, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of expression, nonviolent civil resistance, exactly what you were doing right at the outset. That's the only alternative we have. You cannot expect these judges, these right-wing reactionary judges, to save us. They're not going to do it. I've been before so many of them going back. I think the first anti-nuclear protest case I did in the federal court was 1982, and they've all been kangaroo court proceedings. Every one of them. So they're not going to save us. I'm sorry, I couldn't. No, I don't think we can look to the judges. We have to look to the people.
Well, you know, and I do want to point out that I am still doing these things. I went to Washington, D.C. two times last year to try and get people to join me to clog up Congress, to block Congress members from getting to their offices and to the Capitol to you know, close down streets and stuff like this. It just doesn't seem to be a big, you know, movement from the people to support anything like that, because I fully think it's because we have a Democratic president. It was far easier to organize in the anti-war, pro-accountability movement when we had a Republican.
Well, I think that's right. Obama has bamboozled so many people, even of good faith and goodwill. But look, you know, Obama's, I think, the biggest bait-and-switch operation in American presidential politics since Woodrow Wilson in the 1916 campaign, where he campaigned on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." Meanwhile, he was conspiring behind the back scenes to get us involved into World War One, despite the fact that the American people in Congress did not want to get into World War One. And
right.
It was so bad under Wilson that his Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan, the great commoner, quit and publicly denounced him for this hypocrisy. So, you know, Obama got, you know, he was very good, smart guy. He was behind me at Harvard Law School, and very effective speech making, presentation, and whatever. But certainly, it was very clear to me that the moment he had effectively defeated Mrs. Clinton in the Democratic primary, he immediately pivoted to the extreme right, and that was that. We had it.
Well, he's always been very right of me and my policies, but I think he's just, like you said, I think he's just a gift to the ruling class that they can further their agenda quicker with him than they could under Bush, when Bush was losing so much of his popular support in the country. But
I think you're right that Obama is the velvet glove on the iron fist of the U.S. empire,
mm-hmm.
Whereas Bush was just the iron fist. So
right.
The financial elite who want to run this country, do run the country, decided to put a black velvet glove on the iron fist of U.S. imperialism to replace Bush.
And now even people, like you said, good-hearted people, people of goodwill, that would have right impetus to criticize Obama don't do it, because we get immediately shut down by this horrible accusation of being racist.
I think that if you evaluate Obama by the rule of law, you can avoid the allegations of racism. That is, Obama graduated Harvard Law School. He taught constitutional law at the University of Chicago Law School. He knows exactly what he is doing, and it is certainly fair to hold him under the standards of United States constitutional law and international law. Let's take Libya. As I'm sure you saw on the Internet, they've recycled Obama's statement, that interview he gave with Charlie Savage during
right.
the campaign, that the president can only unilaterally go to war in the event that the United States is attacked. And that is a correct statement of constitutional law given by Obama during the campaign. Well, if you take that statement and apply it to Libya, it is clear, even in accordance with Obama's own words, that he is committing an impeachable act. High crimes and misdemeanors, as defined by the United States Constitution, and warrants impeachment for subverting the Constitution. And you can impeach Obama with his own words. So my advice to your listeners, I've written a book on this if you're interested. I've got two books, one, Protesting Power, War, mm-hmm. Resistance, and Law, and another one, Tackling America's Toughest Questions. And it has all the legal constitutional arguments you could possibly need in those two books, and written in a format that ordinary people can understand them. Not
mm-hmm.
not like law review articles. I wrote them for a more general audience so that, you know, pretty much anyone with an eighth grade education could sit down and read these things and understand the arguments. Now, these books, of course, came out in reaction to Bush.
Right.
But I wrote the conclusion to Tackling America's Toughest Questions after the first month of Obama, and I said, you know, it looks to me like we're going to get an Obama-Bush administration, so regretfully, most of what I was saying would also apply to Obama. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I had a chapter in there on humanitarian intervention, saying it did seem to me that this was going to be the mantra of the Obama administration to justify military attacks. And so for that reason, I was going to include it here sort of on an anticipatory basis. Well, it did come true. And there's a whole chapter in there going through the whole history of humanitarian intervention and what a farce, joke, and fraud it really is. And as you know, the Obama people have now trotted it out to justify what is outright pure aggression against Libya and plunder and war crimes, whatever.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. I've been under attack myself for criticizing this invasion of Libya. But I have two more questions for you, and they're super interesting to me, and I'm sure they will be to my listeners. There's one from Patrizzi, and I don't know if that's a man or a woman, but he or she wants to know, and I don't know anything about this case, what are your thoughts on the recent agreement made in Cobell versus Salazar? Has the Blackfeet Indian tribe finally received some justice? And I know you have worked extensively with American indigenous people.
Well, I guess we'll say they get justice when they finally get some of that money, right?
I don't even know what the case is about.
Right. Well, it's the trust fund that was set up for the Indians looted by the United States government, and we'll just have to see if any of that money materializes. Plus, the other point is, you know, how much the lawyer is going to take off the top, a third? So I guess that will be better than nothing, but, you know, the money will have to, you know, I'm not involved in that particular case, so I'm not aware of all the details, but, you know, the money will have to be appropriated by Congress and then distributed, and, you know, and then the lawyers will take their cut, and then we'll see what's left at the end of the day for the Indians themselves.
All right, so thank you. The last question will be from someone named Robert Wittershein, and I don't know if this is in your purview or if you have a strong opinion about this at all. I haven't seen anything in my research that shows that you would, but this is obviously something that's important to the listener. Are you in favor of a full audit of the Federal Reserve?
Oh, I think the Federal Reserve must be nationalized by Congress.
Yes.
And completely and brought under the control of Congress. Otherwise, we have the bankers running our economy and stealing us blind, which is the point you had originally made with one of your previous questioners. Larry Summers in there working for Obama. Mm-hmm. Now, Summers was the president of Harvard. He was fired by Harvard for trying to impose his neoconservative agenda on Harvard, including saying that women are dumber than men when it comes to math and science. He was on the payroll of hedge funds and Wall Street, and Obama brings him in there to run the economy in the White House. And the Secretary of Treasury, of course, Leitner, I guess, however you pronounce his name, is a flunky of Larry Summers. So Summers was running the whole show, and he's the one who supervised the bailout of the banks and stole us all that money from us. And now Obama is today proposing his austerity budget for the middle class and poor of America, rob Medicare, Medicaid, welfare. Well, Clinton already destroyed welfare, President Clinton, and everything else, attacked Social Security, whatever. So if we want to bring this under control, we need to nationalize the Federal Reserve, put it in the hands of Congress, where there are congressional agencies that can do audits and reports to the people. This has to be stopped. So I would go far beyond an audit. An audit isn't going to mean anything. We have to put these criminals out of business. I'd also be in favor of prosecuting most of them. You know, there's more than enough federal statutes out there to have prosecuted all these bankers and fraudsters, including conspiracy to defraud the United States government. But since Obama's campaign was on their payroll, his biggest contributor was Goldman Sachs,
right.
You know, he's not going to prosecute any of these people.
Right. Well, I guess you did have a good opinion about that, and I really thank you for that. And I just have one last comment. Listener Regina said she doesn't have any questions for you, but she's very excited to hear the interview because she thinks you're brilliant.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm brilliant one way or the other. I think what counts, Cindy, we've all been given talents, you know, by the Almighty. And you have your talents, and I have my talents, and Regina has her talents. And I think what we have to do is figure out what our talents are and put them to work for the benefit of this country, America, and the American people, and the world, mm-hmm. and humanity. I think that's what we all have to do.
And that's exactly what my guest, John Perkins, said last week on the show. So I'm sensing this theme happening. Well, Professor Francis Boyle, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And I hope we can have you on again and talk about you know, other issues that are important to you, important to me, and important to my listeners, and important for change, what the change we really need, not just this, you know, whilst this Madison Avenue crap that has been foisted on us by the Obama administration.
Well, again, thanks, Cindy, and do keep going out there and providing courageous leadership to all of us. I certainly greatly appreciate everything you've done since you got involved in the peace movement after the tragic death of your son.
Well, thank you, Professor Boyle. Thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Okay.
Well, that was our very special guest today, Professor Francis Boyle. And I learned a lot. I hope you did, too, and I hope you enjoyed the interview. I always like it when we open up the floor, so to speak, to calls from the listeners, and I hope I can do that more and more often so you guys can get involved more deeply in Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, because I think it's your soapbox, too. So as always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, my very special guest, Professor Francis Boyle, and you always and ever for listening. I appreciate your support. I appreciate the work that you do, too, whether you have a small soapbox or a large soapbox. It's always very important for us to get up on our soapboxes and never stop. This is Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work. Scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. and sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. Chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. Just get up from your chairs right now. Go stick your head out and yell and keep yelling, I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore. Just get up from your chairs.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.